You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, I'm talking with Robin Winters. Robin, thanks so much for being with me.
I'm happy to be here.
Robin, let's talk about what you're doing now. There's so many things I could talk to you about your work, but what's happening right now? What are you thinking about or working on at the moment?
What I'm thinking about is that the only projects I'm really interested in doing are with people I like and unusual situations that sort of challenge me creatively, like give me an assignment. For instance, I'm having a show right now in Basel, Switzerland, in a bedroom, and it's what's called an off space, similar to alternative space. The place is called Room Room, and the person who has invited me is named Cassidy Toner, and she's decided to do shows that exist for art in her bed. And the first person who did it, I think, made a giant stuffed snake that Cassidy lived with for a month. I made a set of bed sheets and pillowcases that fit the bed and fit the guest bed, and I asked them to put the guest bed on top of the house bed, and then I gave pens and pencils to everybody that they could draw on the bed sheets. I'd also drawn mandalas on each sheet and pillowcase, so there was kind of a starter kit of what one might draw. So that's like the latest project.
So let's talk a little bit more about that project, because I like that. So it's so kind of quirky, too, that type of show, that type of space. So the guest bed is on top of the house bed, so that's kind of like a stacked mattresses, right?
It's two mattresses, one big one and one smaller one. And actually, the smaller one can go on or off the bed, depending on if she has guests or not.
And when those sheets are spread, then people draw on them. Guests that come in add their marks, tags to those sheets.
Yes, I mean Cassidy, the person who is actually the owner of the room and owner of the bed. She's done, I would say, the bulk of the drawing. But then other people have come, friends of hers and guests who come to see the bed have also added to it.
And do people sleep on those drawings too?
Yeah. I gave them fabric markers so they can, you know, they're heat set, washable. She can wash her sheets. The drawings will remain.
I love that. So then when the show is over, she just folds up the sheets, right? It's done.
Yeah. And then it's a gift also. I gave her the sheets. I suppose she could sell them. We didn't really price the sheets. I did have pillowcases in my show at Marlboro that it was just a couple months ago. And I made these kind of tea stands and painted on pillowcases on both sides, and they were hanging on the stands in the middle of the gallery.
So, yeah, that was a wonderful show. Let's also talk about that show, because that's a big contrast, right? Marlboro, of course, is this, you know, great space in
Chelsea.
The city,
and
in Chelsea,
town, yeah.
and the space you were talking about is an off space, as it's called.
In Marlboro.
Like an apartment show.
Yeah. Well, what, you mean the one in Basel?
Yeah, the one in Basel, they're like the opposites, right? Basel was this the room, the off space, the so small,
yeah.
And yet in Marlboro is this kind
it's
of...
It's Marlboro. But
right,
at the same time, in Marlboro, it was also a similar situation in that Tony Fitzpatrick is the person who curates the project room at Marlboro, and he's the one who invited me to come do something. And it was a very intimate space in that sense. afterwards I started calling it the poetry interrogation room, because it was two tables facing each other with two chairs. Everything was in twos, and it was almost as though one person was the interrogator and the other person was the interlocutor. I'm not sure what they would be called. Yeah,
that's me, the interlocutor. So I remember that piece. Those are two tables facing each other, kind of like almost like children's desks, as I remember them, and there were sculptures.
Yes, and there were drawings in the drawers. There were two drawers in each table. There were two dogs. There were two glass vases with flowers in them. There were two glass heads with glass crowns, and there were two small paintings.
So let's just step back and talk about this show then, The Thrum and the Thrall, that was at Marlboro. What was your idea in going into this, especially with the doubles of everything? Or if you want, you can step back further from that and talk about just the approach to this show, because that's so
well,
curious.
Well, honestly, it went through a ton of permutations. Like, you know, I like Tony. We met, we had lunch, we talked. You know, he came to my studio. We went to Finelli's afterwards. First we were talking about doing a show that changed every week, because I have so many things and I have a variety of types of media that I work in. So I could have done a bronze show, a painting show, a glass show, a paper show, you know, a print show, and each week done a different one. And then we were kind of like, that was one idea. Then we thought about it just being like an accumulation show of everything we put up each week we would add to, rather than take down and put up a new show. And by the end, we got to, I was interested in all the twins that I had, because it seemed like I'd done a lot of bilaterally symmetrical left and right figures, everything in doubles. And so we just started looking at all the doubles, and they looked the best. And then the room took on an atmosphere that was the kind of theater I like in the room. So at the end, it read like a poem, which made me happy.
I like that. And let's talk about the chairs then, too. Tell me a little about the ideas of the chairs and the desks, because, as you say, that was kind of a dialogue set up. I mean, so many of the twins seem to be talking to each other, but those chairs and the desks are also having a dialogue.
And they have their companion dogs. So each person who sits in each chair has a little dog kind of sitting to their right. You know, in a gallery setting, people are so timid, meaning they wouldn't pull the chair back and sit in it, because it's in a gallery, and even though it's a desk, a table, a chair, a drawer, they don't open the drawer, they don't sit in the chair, and there's not a guard there saying don't do it. It's just sort of behavioral. But generally, that's what I did when I was there. I would sit in the chair, and, if I was with a friend, they'd sit in the other chair, and we'd chat, and it kind of activated it in a whole different way when somebody else would walk in the room and see me talking with another person. But I didn't really want to do a performance in the gallery, per se, so I wasn't going to sit there every day like I sometimes do. I just wanted to have the feel. It's very much like a theatrical set of a performance.
And was there anything people could do in those drawers? Was there any other way to interact? I mean,
well,
I
also could open them and look at the drawings, which, I left them open a crack so that people could kind of peek in. And so if they wanted, they could open them. If they got really brave, they could take the whole drawer out and there's a piece of glass and you can lift it up and there are four or five drawings underneath hidden in each drawer. But I think that would even be like way too far in that context. So it just looked.
You know, that's a very interesting thing, right? How far will people go? I think that's an interesting issue, because, you know, if if there are other things in this show, right, that encourage that interactivity, or people were asked to, you know, they might. But as you're saying, generally, gallery goers are a pretty shy bunch.
Yeah.
Unless it's, you know, something like what happened at Gavin Brown, I'm sure I heard several years ago, where there was a Rick Ritter Venezia show, a lot of
right,
gifts of stuff, and someone takes the car that was there that, you know, and drove it off, and it wasn't even, you know, it was just someone left their keys in the car. So how do you know, I mean, how do you think about audiences, I guess, what I'm asking, in terms of your expectations of them with something like that? Because I would normally sit down, though I didn't in that show, but I would normally, I would do that, but also leafing through the drawings. Well, I would do that if I went to the gallery desk and said, can I sit down at that desk and do what I want?
Yeah.
I would. It's...
No, but I think that I didn't set it up for that. Like, had it really been interactive, it would have been clearly interactive in such a way that everybody who saw it would know they could interact with it. So I left it in a gray area, because I kind of wanted it to feel as though there'd been an interaction and that you were witnessing it almost. So, it was a tableau in that sense.
Right. So it feels a little bit like there was a performance
stuff,
there.
What's that?
Yeah, it does feel as though there was a performance there or a happening. That was the feeling I had, that something happened in those chairs kind of thing.
Yeah.
But,
well, I mean, over the years, many things have happened at those desks and in those chairs, and some of it, I would say, was very performative. You know, so it's a little bit of like a transplant archaeology, that all the objects in the room I've lived with for quite some time, and, you know, I generally tend to do a mini retrospective every time I show anyway. I like my old work and my new work mixed up. Yeah.
And there are other interactive elements in the show as well, right?
There's a hat box on each corner on top of a cardboard box, and they also could be interactive in that if anyone opened the hat box, they'd find there's a blue rubber top hat in one of the boxes and a yellow rubber top hat in the other box, and there's probably 10 drawings in each box and a couple of handmade objects. But again, in terms of exploration, I doubt that very many people actually open the hat boxes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, interesting.
That would be interesting.
We're afraid to touch.
Well, I hear afterwards, you know, some people be like, yeah, man, I looked in your hat boxes, you know. But you never know.
Right. So this is such an interesting contrast in show. After that show, how did you feel about that? How was the reception of that show? And I mean, there was comments like that, but how did you feel that went over? Because the show itself is something of an experiment, right? Because you're adding to it, it's also not really defined beginning and an end almost, right?
Well, no, because I ended up not really adding to it. Ultimately, it was static after the installation in terms of the only thing that changed were new flowers in the vases. But, you know, I felt really good about it in terms of the, again, I want to use the word poetry of it, and the reception in terms of people who felt it and saw it. There was a kind of familial, everybody who knows me probably was very comfortable there because it had all of my kind of iconography around that they know. And then people who didn't know my work, it's very user-friendly and accessible, so anybody could kind of so-called get it or at least get something from it.
You know, it's you work in so many mediums in so many ways. I feel like I should also ask you about your Facebook interactions and work there. I mean, if I understand correctly, is it to a certain people or people on Facebook that you write texts, poems on their birthday?
Well, I kind of write a poem like a song, and I send it to people over the year, the people who are my friends on Facebook. I send it as a birthday poem on their birthday. And, you know, I may write one or two different poems a year, but I don't write a brand new poem every day for every single person, or I think I would get a little nuts.
But that's a wonderful thing, and
I've been doing it about eight or nine years now.
Right. So how many have you written? You've written a lot. Is that part of your practice, or do you see it in a different way?
Yeah. Say that again.
Is that do you see that as part of your practice, or to me that feels like a form of social practice almost, but it also seems like it's it kind of articulates just who you are, like your sentiment. You're a nice guy.
I don't see any difference really between private practice and social practice in terms of kind of the sentiment and the thrust of, you know, spreading joy and love in the world or whatever the hell you do. You know what I mean? That, like when I first moved to New York, I was like 21 years old and it was the big city. Like, you know, there are so many guitar pickers in Nashville and there I was, an artist in New York. My first reaction was to make little folded paper notes with like drawings and writing inside and put a red wax seal on them and then just drop them randomly in different places around the city. As to whether anybody found them, you know, I'd love to someday go to somebody's place and see one of those, you know, from 50 years ago, 40-something years ago.
And that's interesting. That's a nice comparison with the, you know, messaging texts and poems on Facebook. Why did you do that first project? That's a wonderful one to mention and seems, you know, a bit fluxus and or something else. What prompted you to do that? It's such a wonderful way also to engage with New York, like you're saying, you know, in a sea of guitar pickers.
Yeah, and, exactly, right? The kind of anonymity of all of us. And, I mean, that's also something I would say I use as a quality control on my own artwork in terms of thinking, if I make this thing and I put it out on the street, will anybody want it? Will they pick it up? How quickly will they grab it from the garbage and take it home? You know, that's one level of, like, you know, veracity.
But you never knew whether they picked it up, so it wasn't actually that level of veracity because you just dropped it. You don't actually know if it was picked up, held.
In that case, yes, but I'm thinking more of like if I make a blown glass piece or I make a painting or I make a drawing that somebody can visually see sitting in the garbage, how long would it take? You know, I haven't actually tested it. That would be a really fun piece just to, you know, kind of film the progress of the work floating down the sidewalk.
Right, or going into the trash, whatever it is, yeah.
Yeah.
That's interesting. So since you brought up the early beginnings in New York, and that's a wonderful start, after that you were, especially since you just mentioned Finelli's too, you began meeting people, and there was a community of New York that you seemed to get involved with fairly quickly. Is that right?
Totally. I had jobs. I worked for Donald Judd. I worked for Joan Jonas. I worked at the Spring Street Bar. So I was kind of immediately engulfed in like downtown Soho, early 70s. Spring Street Bar was like an incredible place because they had a free Sunday brunch and all the artists would come on Sunday. And the artists at that point, it was like Robert Smithson and Richard Serra and Keith Sonier and Dorothea Rockburn and Joan Jonas and Trisha Brown, and I mean just so many different people all went to that Sunday brunch, and I was between waiting on them and sometimes not and just hanging out with them, but I made some friends from that time that have lasted forever.
And that also led to just your career growing, right? That was when you had a number of
totally, absolutely.
Shows in the 70s.
I credit Marcia Tucker with a huge amount of my career exposure in that she curated me into an early Whitney Biennial in, I think, 1975. And I did a two-month performance where I performed 8 hours a day every day behind a one-way mirror in the museum. And so Marcia, you know, really basically kind of discovered me. I met her in San Francisco, and she was like a visiting lecturer there at the Art Institute, and I was like, I really want to come to New York, and she was totally friendly, and in fact sublet me her loft when I first got there, and so.
And at that time, you're still working in different mediums, but at the Whitney, just to talk about that, behind the one-way mirror, you're doing a performance. It was of a character, right,
yeah.
Bob?
It was W.B. Behrman Bags a Job or Diary of a Dreamer. So in that piece, I was W.B. Behrman, and my job was kind of this, between the Wizard of Oz, the man behind the curtain, between that and a sort of Svengali one-way mirror, appear, disappear, magic act, and then a little bit like an autistic child who just had a little room to live in, who is rocking and twiddling a lot during the day and making small clay objects sitting on the floor. So it would depend. And you might come in and you read a sign outside. All it says is booth with live performer. So you walk in, and what do you see? You see a mirror. And because there's a little curtain, you go inside the curtain and there's a mirror. And that's all you see. And then you go out and somebody else comes in, and then I immediately reveal and they see inside, and I'm inside the booth wearing a bear mask, rocking back and forth and clicking two metal bars together, doing some kind of ritualistic dance around the room or something. And then I quickly fade the mirror back into mirror again. So maybe
so explain to me how I'm glad you mentioned that, because that's what I didn't understand. How does the mirror become a mirror? In other words, you can
it's all on lighting.
Around?
If the light is bright on the viewer's side, it's a mirror. If the light is the other way, it's a mirror on my side. You know what I mean? So it all depends on the brightness of the light on the mirror.
So this was a huge performance. It was long, 8 hours a day. I mean, how that must have kind of formed you. That was around the time that there was some other people doing durational work.
Definitely. Actually, Chris Burden was doing a piece at Ron Feldman Gallery at the same time as I was in the Whitney. And in his piece, he was totally starving himself up on a shelf for a month. And I was kind of offended, to be honest, because I was like the happy worker in the museum, like really trying to do my job, like, you know, to somehow like give some mystical, joyful experience to the crowd, right? And, you know, I sort of thought there was a lot of very solipsistic artwork that was going on that was all about self-abuse and mutilation and, you know, or torturing your audience, and so I kind of had reactions to that.
That's
but there
interesting,
was that
right,
kind of work going on.
Well, it was in the context of that work, and as you were saying, I mean, you were curated in the context of that work, so
yes.
Whitney was also, you know, staking some ground a little bit in the performance world that was growing so much then, that was so active.
Right, because it was minuscule then.
And so you've done a lot of projects between then and now, and is there one other we should talk about? Like I could pick one, another project from the 70s.
Well, I love the Chambre d'Ami in Ghent in Belgium. That's one of my favorite projects. It was 50 artists invited to work in 50 private homes in the town of Ghent, and each artist picked their home. We all took a tour around Ghent and we looked at different homes, and I found a home that had 5 adopted kids and a rabbit in the backyard and a big library full of art books, and it was a woman who was an art historian teaching at the local art school. So I picked her house, and the subtitle of the show, Chambre d'Amis, it said, "There is always room in our house for Albrecht Dürer," because apparently Albrecht Dürer went to Ghent to draw a rhinoceros, and so the people of Ghent honor Albrecht Dürer somehow. And anyway, that was the subtitle, and I saw they had this rabbit, and my idea was I was going to make a beautiful house for the rabbit and kind of homage to Albrecht Dürer's rabbit drawings. And the rabbit looked a little miserable out in the backyard anyway, so I thought that would be a nice artwork to make. Then I got back a few months later, and the rabbit had died. So I didn't really know what to do. And I sat in her house, and I looked at her books, and I started reading some books just because I was a little despondent and bored and didn't know what I was going to do for an art project. And a letter fell out of her book, and it was from Madame Leger, Ferdinand Leger's wife, to this art historian. And she knew a lot of well-known French artists. So anyway, she also hid letters in her books. And when I was a kid, I had made Abraham Lincoln letters that I hid in my father's law books. And so I looked at these books, and I, like, a light bulb went off.
Wait, let me just ask that a minute. When you were a kid, you hid letters? You mean that were for, that looked like they were
I made
your own
fake
letters?
Abraham Lincoln letters, just like I tried to be like Abraham Lincoln, and I tea-stained the typewriter paper and folded it up, and it was like a pirate map or something. It was like I was just faking these antique letters. But so years later, I'm looking at these books, and I'm just like, okay, I'm going to draw from the books, and then I'm going to put the drawings back in the books, but I'm going to make two copies, one for myself and one for the public and one for the private in the house. And so then I organized the house in such a way that there was a velvet rope in front of the library, and you couldn't actually touch the books, but in the hallway there was a Marcel Brotard's artwork that said Musée non enfant, museum not for children. And then there was a James Ensor drawing of skeletons pissing on flowers called Le Joyeux Arrosoir, the Happy Waterers. And so I made this sort of homage to Belgian artists in the hallway and closed off the private house. But I had a docent who stood there who gave an excellent explanation of my project and told people that if they wanted to actually see the drawings that had been done by Mr. Winters in the house, that they should go to the museum in Ghent and see the drawings. Then in the museum in Ghent, I put my drawings on the outside of a Daniel Buren piece, because mm-hmm. Daniel Buren made a piece that was the private guest room of the richest collector in the town of Ghent, Anton Herbert. He had like a six-story building. Each floor was like an homage to Art Povera, like he had a whole floor of Gunellas, a whole floor of Mario Mertz, whatever. So he got to pick his artist, Daniel Buren, and Daniel came and he said, "I want my house private." And so my reaction was to put my work on the outside of Danielle's piece, and they all got mad at me for calling out the collector for having their house private when all the people in Ghent opened their homes. But the museum director, Jan Hoot, totally was on my side. He said, "I paid for the walls, you did the inside of the guest room, Robin can have the outside." So that was kind of a fun public
I like that. I'm glad you mentioned that show. Yeah, that's
interaction with the other artists. What's that?
Yeah, I'm glad you mentioned that show. That's such an interesting one, and I love that you were forging Lincoln letters as a kid. How old were you when you were doing that?
Oh, I don't know, probably nine, somewhere in that range.
I love that story. So to step back, you've done, you know, so much different work, and like the Marlboro show was filled with, you know, all different mediums, and you know, and then we're to talk about the show at Ghent is again you know, another way of working with a situation, with individuals.
Well, the real question is, where does one get one's inspiration? And, you know, for me, it's writing love letters. It's if I meet somebody and I can make something beautiful for them, if I can set up a situation where people get, you know, some sense of some abstract narrative life that has been lived that they can walk through and feel something from. So, I mean, that's why I like projects that are challenging, because they make me think outside my box. Because what do I do alone? I make paintings and drawings and do a lot of printmaking and glass blowing and things that I can do on my own. I'm kind of a productive character. I mean, I make stuff every day or whatever. And but so if somebody says, hey, do a radio interview, I'm so thrilled, because it's like just a different thing.
Mm. And but at the same time, you're also producing. I mean, one of the questions is also, how does it get into the marketplace, right? There's so much that you're doing that's, you know, kind of about a conversation, or it's about something more ephemeral, more poetic, a lot of the things we've been discussing. And then there's prints and painting and glasswork and all of this other objects that are also making it into the marketplace somehow. Or
that's
the
trickle-down
things, right?
Theory. I mean, you know,
but
maybe
it seems
a quarter
to be working,
of my
like
work.
You're an unusual artist that way, a very unusual artist, I think. I don't know anyone else that works in as many mediums as you and can inhabit both an ephemeral space completely and one that's engaged with the market.
Right. Well, the market's a kind of complicated one. I'm like in that mid-career phase, so it's not like I'm having a major market moment or anything, but my prices have stayed stable, and I've sold work over the years. So, you know, if a quarter of my work is in the public and the rest I've hoarded and taken care of, it's still, you know, money in the bank in that sense of it's still valuable objects. I mean, I learned this trading with best products when I was a kid. I first moved to New York, and I got a deal to trade a painting with best products, and I got a staple gun, a TV set, a cam recorder, whatever. I got a whole bunch of electronic equipment, all of which, of course, I don't have anymore.
But how did that trade come about? Did you offer
what?
That trade? How did that trade come about?
I can't even remember. It might have been through Larry Aldrich, or it was somebody who was arranging, curating for best products, and the deal, or it could have been Ivan Karp even, who had OK Harris Gallery on West Broadway. But the thing is that at the end of all that time, the painting's still brand new.
Mm.
And all their products have gone by the wayside. So that's sort of an intrinsic value, faith in art, that is both in the marketplace and kind of outside of it, you know?
Mm. Yeah, that's true. And did that lead you to continue? That sounds like it set a pattern, or was somehow very important with how you're interacting with the marketplace, because that's kind of an unusual story. The idea of trading, the idea of that kind of...
Well, we all were doing stuff like that at the time, trading with bars for tabs, like, you know, the local and one university place, and we would trade drawings to have a tab at the bar. I haven't even seen those drawings again, but they're somewhere floating around, you know?
Right. And does that still happen now?
What's that?
Does that still
happen
now?
Oh, yeah, I've traded with dentists. I have a dentist that I had a lot of dental work that I had to get done. And so I've done, often I've made trades with people. But and then in the marketplace, it's kind of like if you slowly grow your prices. I mean, I think there are people who price themselves out of existence that had to take a step backwards in the whole thing because their prices were like tulip mania. In fact, Lucian Smith just did a show with the text in the show. They were paintings of tulips, and the text was about tulip mania. and he's a kind of case in point that his prices were quite high at one point. I don't know what they're like now, but
yeah, it's right. Things are changing, and so it's great talking to you about all this. Is there something we should mention before I ask you the last question? There'll be links in here so people can learn more, but is there something I should have asked or anything upcoming that you want people to know about?
No, nothing I can think of.
So what are you reading at the moment, Robin? I'm always curious.
I'm reading B. Traven. Do you know who B. Traven is? Treasure of the Sierra Madre. He's a German anarchist who wrote under a pseudonym.
Wow. That sounds like a fascinating character. I don't know anything about him.
And I just started this book called Trozos, which I know nothing about it because I literally just started it. So,
well, Robin, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today. I really appreciate your work.
Hey, it was great to talk to you, too.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.